This is VOA News. I'm Tommy McNeil. U.S. Secretary of State Mike Pompeo is blaming Iran for Thursday's attacks on two oil tankers in the Gulf of Oman. One of the tankers was set on fire and sent up smoke thick and black enough to be seen by satellites in space. Speaking at the State Department Thursday, the secretary noted that Iran was behind other recent similar attacks on shipping and that no proxy group in the region has the resources and ability to attack a tanker with such a high degree of sophistication.
This assessment is based on intelligence, the weapons used, the level of expertise needed to execute the operation, recent similar Iranian attacks on shipping, and the fact that no proxy group operating in the area has the resources and proficiency to act with such a high degree of sophistication.
Britain's Foreign Secretary Jeremy Hunt said that he has consulted with Pompeo, and while the UK would make its own assessment of the situation, if Iran is responsible, it would be deeply unwise escalations of tensions. Iran's mission to the UN said it categorically rejects the U.S. claim and condemns it in the strongest possible terms. There's a tentative plan between the Trump administration and Guatemala that would block Central Americans from seeking asylum in the United States. In a 7-page draft obtained by VOA, the unsigned agreement would establish a safe third country protocol between the U.S. and Guatemala. The draft is set to be presented to the government in Guatemala City this week. Migrants fleeing persecution in El Salvador and Honduras would be required to seek asylum in Guatemala, a gateway to Mexico and the United States. With few exceptions, those who continue north to the U.S. without testing their chances in Guatemala would be sent back to Guatemala by U.S. immigration authorities. This is VOA News. President Trump is facing criticism from both parties after saying he is open to accepting political dirt from a foreign power. AP's Washington correspondent Sagar Magani.
The president says he might not necessarily tell the FBI if a foreign power offered political dirt on an opponent.
There's nothing wrong with listening.
Democratic reaction to his interview with ABC News' George Stephanopoulos was swift.
That's an assault on our democracy.
House Speaker Nancy Pelosi saying the president doesn't know right from wrong. Even GOP allies like Lindsey Graham, who usually steer clear of criticizing him, say the president's answer as to whether he'd accept foreign help should have been no.
I think it's a mistake.
Sagar Magani, Washington.
As it puts its support squarely behind Hong Kong's increasingly embattled leader, Carrie Lam, censors in China are working overtime to scrub the internet and social media of any discussion of rallies and the fierce debate over an extradition law that would allow extradition to China from Hong Kong. It has spurred violent clashes between protesters and police. In Hong Kong, there is deep mistrust and concerns about rule of law in China, where any individual who is perceived as a threat to the state or Communist Party can be silenced, disappeared, or sent to jail. In China, discussion of such cases is largely silenced, but in Hong Kong, they are openly discussed, analyzed, and criticized. Under the so-called One Country, Two Systems model, Hong Kong was promised to be able to keep its independent legal system and freedoms when the former British colony was returned to China in 1997. White House Press Secretary Sarah Sanders, one of President Trump's staunchest defenders, is leaving at the end of the month. AP's Ed Donahue.
President Trump called Sanders a warrior.
She is going to be going, I guess you could say, private sector.
Sanders is one of the few remaining staff members who worked on the Trump campaign.
It's one of the greatest jobs I could ever have. I've loved every minute, even the hard minutes.
And Sanders has had a lot of hard minutes with the press. And special counsel Robert Mueller's Russia report revealed she admitted to investigators she made an unfounded claim about the firing of James Comey.
I've heard from countless members of the FBI that are grateful and thankful for the president's decision.
What's next for Sarah Sanders?
If we can get her to run for the governor of Arkansas, I think she'll do very well. And I'm
trying to get her to do that.
Ed Donahue, Washington.
9 people have been killed, 13 others wounded in a suicide blast at a police checkpoint in eastern Afghanistan. Provincial officials say security personnel and civilians are among the victims of the attack Thursday in Jalalabad. I'm Tommy McNeil, VOA News.
Africa. Welcome to Daybreak Africa from the Voice of America. I'm James Butte in Washington. Today's Friday, June 14th, and here are some of the stories we are covering. Kenya announces a 3.2 trillion shillings budget with taxes on alcohol, cigarettes, and gambling.
Kenya shilling 14.4 billion for Kenyatta National Hospital, 9.2 billion for Moi Teaching and Referral Hospital.
The duty of a bottle of whiskey will go up by 24 shillings. The excise duty of a packet of 20 cigarettes will increase by 8 shillings.
Henry Rotich is Kenya's Cabinet Treasury Secretary. Uganda's government presents to Parliament the economic and development aspects of its 2019-2020 budget. South Sudan fires its petroleum minister, and Cameroon's Parliament Speaker claims foreign interference in the country's internal affairs.
The National Assembly President Kabaye Dibril cannot warn the international community not to interfere in the affairs of Cameroon, because Cameroon cannot be an island.
Nijon Frundi is founder of Cameroon's main opposition Social Democratic Front Party. We will look at teeth carving in Tanzania, and a Congolese comic book artist is hoping his story will soon be launched into an animation series. Those stories plus Samson O'Malley's sports are coming up on Daybreak Africa. Kenya has announced a 3.2 trillion shillings budget for 2019-2020 with taxes on alcohol, cigarettes, and gambling. Marie Ojiambo's report from Nairobi.
The 3 trillion Kenya shillings budget has raised questions from Kenyans and other political leaders on how to finance the budget. Presenting the budget before the parliament yesterday, Thursday, Treasury Cabinet Secretary Henry Rotich said that the Big Four agenda of the government will receive the highest amount set aside. Rotich has, however, hit hard the gambling industry and the liquor manufacturers, who will be required to pay more tax for their products.
Kenya shilling 14.4 billion for Kenyatta National Hospital, 9.2 billion for Moi Teaching and Referral Hospital.
The duty of a bottle of whiskey will go up by 24 shillings.
The excise duty of a packet of 20 cigarettes will increase by 8 shillings to 61 shillings per packet.
As a way of controlling expenditure, the government has proposed the introduction of credit cards for state officials, local and foreign travel. Mr. Rotich says the Kenya Revenue Authority will be required to collect 2.1 trillion to finance the budget, or else the country goes back to borrowing, which may drag back Kenya to debts that is already overwhelming the taxpayers. Foreigners visiting the country will be exempted from the Kenya Revenue Authority PIN requirement to own a bank account and invest in the country. Rotich says foreigners should be granted exceptions while accessing bank and other financial services.
The government is keen to position Kenya as a prime financial center in East and Central Africa. The first step to achieve this is to make our financial services accessible to both Kenyans and our visitors.
However, members of parliament had different views on the budget allocations. Wajir South Member of Parliament Mahmoud Sheikh Mohammed said that the country should not have more export than imports.
The investments that we are putting in any fiscal plan is something that really needs to be looked at. Our import, our exports, our debts. These are the three key things that are important. Now, our exports must be higher than our imports if we want to see a healthy or a better growth of this economy.
Another member, Wasin Gishu Women Representative Gladys Beausoleil, says the agricultural sector, especially the staple food for Kenya, has not been taken into consideration, and therefore the government may fail to achieve its food security, which is among the Big Four agenda.
They have provided funding under that food security sector for miraa revitalization, for coffee. So there is an anomaly, because you cannot fund one type of agriculture and not the food part. How will we achieve food security in that sense?
Kenya has always had huge budgets in the recent past that has burdened the taxpayers to facilitate, and hence making the country fall trap of debts. Reporting for VOA's Daybreak Africa, I am Maureen Ojiambo in Nairobi, Kenya.
The Ugandan government on Thursday presented to Parliament an ambitious 40 trillion shillings budget, or about $11 billion, promising to grow the economy and transform people's lives. President Yoweri Museveni asked leaders from both the ruling party and the opposition to sensitize the population into engaging in commercial enterprises that can bring about development. But as Mugumi Davis Rakarinji reports from Kampala, one analyst says the government needs to invest more in agriculture, the number one employer in Uganda.
The theme for this year's budget is industrialization for job creation and shared prosperity. While presenting the budget, Finance Minister Matiaka Seija said the government will focus on interventions aimed at increasing the wealth and improving the livelihoods of all Ugandans.
The financial 2019-20 budget seeks to deliver inclusive growth and develop the vast majority of our people by ensuring gainful jobs, increased incomes, and greater wealth for Ugandan households.
Kaseja says the government will collect at least 20 trillion Uganda shillings from taxes and 9 tax sources such as fines, driving permits, and passport fees. The rest, he said, will be obtained from both domestic and external borrowing. However, Kaseja acknowledges widening income inequalities between people in urban areas and those in rural areas. He says the best way to bridge the gap is by equipping citizens to practice commercialized farming. Ugandan President Yoweri Museveni agrees. President Museveni says leaders must help sensitize citizens to practice modern methods of agriculture.
We can continue talking about the role, the what, all these things we talk about. But with these families which are outside the money economy, it's a very big handicap. And it can be, these people can be brought into the money economy.
Frederick Kawoya, who works for the NGO Action Aid, says the government ought to have allocated more resources to the agriculture sector, which employs the biggest percentage of the population.
From a proportionate angle, still the sector is being allocated about 2.6% of the budget of the national cake. And this is in contradiction to the commitment the government made of allocating at least 10% to the sector.
Agriculture employs about 70% of Uganda's population. The government says it will spend 20% on works and transport, 10% on energy and mineral development, 10% on education, 9% on health, and 8% on security. For VOA News, I am Mugume Davis Rwakarinji in Kampala, Uganda.
South Sudan President Salva Kiir this week fired his petroleum minister Ezekiel Lo Gatkuov and named Awad Daniel Chan as his replacement. The petroleum minister is one of the most powerful in South Sudan, accounting for more than 90% of the country's total revenues. In a flattery thank you letter sent to President Salva Kiir, which copy was sent also to Daybreak Africa, Gatkuov said he will continue to support the president as he endeavors to cement peace in South Sudan. A Juba-based economist says Gatkuov was never being transparent about how the oil ministry's funds were being spent. Winnie Sirino reports for VOA from Juba.
Ezekiel Lo Gatkuov was appointed by President Kiir on August 2, 2016 on the SPLM-IO ticket under first Vice President Taban Dengai. Augustino Ting Mayai, a policy analyst at the Juba-based SAD Institute, says during Ezekiel Lo Gatkuov's first year as petroleum minister, oil production and revenues declined as conflict raged across the country. Mayai acknowledges that Gatkuov had worked to increase oil production over the past year, but despite increased production, the higher oil revenues did not benefit the general public.
There have been widespread complaints from the regular person to the level of central bank that money is not coming through. And that shows, in a nutshell, deficit in Ezekiel's leadership.
Mayai says the Petroleum Act stipulates that revenues generated from oil must be deposited in the central bank account and not be spent or circulated by the Minister of Petroleum. He says, contrary to what the law requires, Gatkuov's ministry signed deals with oil companies and individual businessmen, a clear violation of the Petroleum Act.
Ezekiel's job was to milk the cow and to make it available to the institution that would distribute it to the general public or the consumers. That doesn't seem to have been done. Ezekiel was directly contracting out our oil, project-based activities were undertaken, which were completely outside his docket. That amounts to criminality. If the system protocols or the laws were to be implemented, Ezekiel should go straight to jail.
But I see nothing happened to Katkos due to politics and systemic weaknesses in the country's legal institutions. Katkos was subject of ridicule in social media last year after he said during a BBC interview.
And we are stabilizing the situation in the country. Economy is booming. As a Minister of Petroleum, we are working hard to make sure that the money that we are getting from oil is actually used to provide service.
Mayai says Gatkoth's comment about a booming economy in South Sudan is patently false. He says Gatkoth does not understand how a country's economy works. Mayai says the government should have used oil revenues to improve academic institutions and technology infrastructure across the country, which he says lag far behind compared to the rest of the region. He also accuses Gatkoth of exaggerating the amount of oil being produced per day. Gatkoth was not reachable by phone. The former minister is out of the country. He flew from Russia after attending an economic event to Nairobi and has reportedly proceeded to Nigeria on a private visit. For VOA News, I am Winnie Serino in Juba.
You're listening to Daybreak Africa on the Voices of America. I'm James Butte in Washington. Today is Friday, June 14th. Daybreak Africa time is 16 minutes past the hour. In Cameroon, the leader of the main opposition Social Democratic Front Party says it is regrettable for the Speaker of the National Assembly to claim foreign interference in the country's internal affairs. John Frundi says the government of President Paul Biya has failed to address gross human rights violations in the country's English-speaking regions. Remarks came after the National Assembly Speaker, Kavie Djibril, condemned what he said is foreign interference in Cameroon's internal affairs. Here's John Frundi.
The National Assembly President, Kavie Djibril, cannot warn the international community not to interfere in the affairs of Cameroon, because Cameroon cannot be an island. If those of other countries are condemned and Cameroon joined in condemning those of other countries, I think that Cameroon should humble herself enough for other people to criticize her.
He is of the opinion that Cameroon has become an object of conspiracy intended to destabilize the Central African country. Do you share that sentiment?
Yeah, well, when he's saying that, he knows what they are doing, because they started filing guns right from 1992. When the SDF won the elections, they bought guns and gave to all the CPDM leaders to take care of themselves. But unfortunately for them, we never went to war. And these are the guns that children took and were doing armed robbery on Sabga Hills and the Adamawa North and Far North. So it's Cameroon that led the president for a war by first trying to arm the top wits of the CPDM with guns. So if today the wars have come, they should not complain. They should contain them.
Do you share in his view that the government is working very hard to restore durable peace and security in the Anglophone regions?
He's working hard in futility, because it depends in which direction he's working hard to. By telling people, lay down your arms, and his army is shooting at the embers, I don't think that he's serious in the peace deal that he wants to broker. Because even some of his ministers have their own wings of the Ambazonians, who are very wicked on the field to blackmail the real Ambas who are fighting for the Anglophone restoration and their problems.
A lot of countries have said they will not negotiate with terrorists, which the government of Cameroon has described the Ambazonia guys fighting the administration or security agencies. Now, there is a platform, they said, to dialogue and to negotiate. That is why the Prime Minister came recently to meet you and other elders to try to find a way to resolve this crisis. Where is this effort at this moment?
When the Prime Minister left the Northwest, they opened fire and burnt quite a lot of houses in Mankon and caused quite a lot of destruction. When he came to the Southwest and left, they shot killed the four-month-old child that I've just passed now and seen the parents to express my own condolences to them. Well, I appreciate what the Prime Minister is doing and trying to do, but I do not see it yielding any much fruit.
Are you making any effort at all to meet President Paul Biya face-to-face to address some of these challenges as an opposition leader and a prominent one at that too?
I've written letters to Mr. Biya, but he's never answered me. And I think that at the present moment, Mr. Biya's mind is very confused, and I do not see how he can get himself involved in any meaningful dialogue.
John Frundi is the leader of Cameroon's main opposition Social Democratic Front Party. He spoke with VOA's Peter Clotty from the commercial capital Douala. Human teeth sharpening, or carving, is the practice of manually sharpening the teeth, usually the front ones. The practice is common in many cultures around the globe, from the Ramohadas of Mexico to the Zapo-Zap people of the Democratic Republic of Congo and the Bush Grables of Liberia. The Zanaki tribe of Tanzania also practices the tradition. Even founding president Mwalimu Julius Nyerere is said to have carved his upper front teeth. For some cultures, teeth carving was used for beautification, while for others, it was a sign of coming of age for boys and girls. Sabina Mugisha Bingma from Tanzania has written a book about the teeth carving entitled Sanda, the Girl with the Magical Smile.
The reason I decided to write this book is for my little kids. I have two kids here in America. So I wanted to leave something for them just to know where I am from. My dad told me a little bit of the story when I was a little girl. So when I have the kids here, and I was like, this is the right time for me to just write something for them to look back.
Why teeth carving or teeth sharpening? I mean, why did you focus on that particular aspect? Just to express culture or what?
Yeah, that was also to put this culture, people so they can know about it. It's something like never been spoken out. Even in my country, Tanzania, they haven't really talked about it or write about it. So for me, it was very interesting part to start researching about it and write so other people know we have this culture that they might not be popular right now, but they were used before and people embraces them. And I have a good example where the first president of Tanzania, Mwalimu Julius Kambarage Nyerere, went through that process.
As I was talking to you just informally before we began talking, teeth carving or sharpening, it seems to me it's not just Tanzania. I know that in my village where I was born in Liberia, people did it. Why do people in Tanzania take on teeth sharpening?
So in Tanzania, what I really read about it and research about it, it was a more of a beauty. Also, it was showing a young man or young woman has passed that being like a child, now you're an adult. So it shows you you have more responsibility in a community. When people they kind of spot you, it's like, wow, this girl or man went through this teeth curving, so she's matured enough and they can trust the person. Also, it was just a vanity. It's something like you have to be proud of when you went to do it.
As I thought about it, I said, wow, even going to the dentist here with all the modern medicine, I'm afraid to go to the dentist, let alone going to a teeth carver or a teeth sharpener in my village to do that. That must be painful.
Yes, it is painful. And I believe also on those culture, you were celebrated. So that part of being celebrated when you have done it. I would say even here in the modern ways, I will take my kids to the dentist. They don't really want it, but I am trying to praise them after they are done and did good. And they're like, well, you see, you went through it.
Sabina, thank you very much again. Look, congratulations.
Thank you so much, JMC. I am so happy and honored just to discuss about these cultures.
I'm so happy also to speak with you.
Thank you so much.
Sabina Mugasa Binkman from Tanzania is the author of a book on teeth carving. She's speaking with me from Minneapolis in Minnesota. A comic book artist from the Democratic Republic of Congo is hoping that his inclusive story called Little Orishas, about a brother and a sister duo in heaven who are trying to become gods, will soon be launched into an animation series. Akanj Kiyindu's story draws from Yoruba and other African mythologies to help teach high school kids important lessons drawn from African traditions.
A few kind of underlying message in the series. One of them, basically first representation, acceptance, like self-acceptance, accepting who you are, how you look, look like, because we decided that we wanted to make those gods like the way we designed them. First, we're going to go with the looks. The way we designed them, we decided to make them to exaggerate the facial features, like the big lips and stuff, so that the people that read this, the primary audience, which is Black African, but also African Americans or people of African descent living outside of Africa, to love themselves in a country or in a society where we grew up with all these images of Black is not cool, Black is not beautiful and stuff. So we wanted to make Black look cool and Black look nice. So we want the kids to love themselves, to love how they look like.
Do you think beyond looks, Mr. Yamakazi, that it's also worthwhile talking about Orishas, talking about African mythology, talking about Yoruba mythology as ways to put more value on ways of looking at things from the African perspective?
It's not just the Yoruba mythology. So that's the second part of it. It's the melting pot of mythology. So we went on to research around Africa and how different myths and folklores in Africa made us grow, like in communities.
That was Akanj Kiyindu, author of Little Orishas. He was speaking to Ricky Stryer from Pointe Noire in the Republic of Congo. Time for Daybreak Africa Sports, and here is Samson O'Malley in Abuja, Nigeria. A very good Friday morning to you, Samson.
Good Friday morning to you, James. We begin the sports with the latest update from the 2019 FIFA Women's World Cup, where South Africa's Banyana Banyana are still looking for a first point after their debut World Cup after playing two matches. A solitary strike by Li Ying gave China a 1-0 victory over South Africa in Paris on Thursday and ensured that Group B leaders Germany are the first guaranteed qualifier for the last 16 of the Women's World Cup. Debutants South Africa are now likely out of contention, but the forgiving format of the tournament means they are not yet eliminated, with four third-place teams going through out of the six groups. Coach Destry Ellis is Banyana Banyana head coach.
We knew it was going to be a battle out there. We also had a couple of chances, and when we started chasing the game, obviously China got more chances, because if you're 1-0 down with 10 minutes to go, we're not happy to be 1-0 down, so we're trying to get the equalizer and maybe get the winner. And that's when China got a lot more opportunities, when we push players up. Obviously, the result is not what we wanted.
Away from the Women's World Cup, Nigeria's Enyimba International Football Club claimed a record 8th title in emphatic manner as they were crowned champions of the abridged 2018-2019 Nigeria Professional Football League season. Enyimba won 4 of their 5 matches during the championship playoffs, losing only to Kano Pillars 2-0 to gather a total of 12 points. They will now play in the CAF Champions League next season. Coach Usman Abdallah is one of Nigeria's most successful football clubs.
This year the aim is to win the league, at the same time get back to the continent. Those are the two goals we set for the year, and we did it. We're happy to achieve those two things.
With the 2019 AFCON just a few days away, Algeria coach Djamel Belmadi has confirmed that Haris Belkebla has been dropped from the Algeria African Cup of Nations squad. Belmadi explained that it was in order to maintain discipline in the squad ahead of the finals in Egypt, which begins on the 21st of June. His omission follows video footage of Belkebla appearing on there exposing his backside on a live stream of an online game. In athletics news, female Olympic and world 800 meters champion Caster Semenya has been denied participation in her favored 800 meters race in Morocco, the athlete said on Thursday.
I can run any events I want. It can be 100 meters, it can be 200, it can be long jump, it can be heptathlon, you name it. You know, I'm a talented athlete, so I'm not worried about anything else. Even if I have to withdraw from 800 meters, it don't matter no more. I think I've won anything I've ever wanted.
This is despite Switzerland's highest court rejecting an IAAF request for eligibility regulations to be reimposed on the athlete. And that's it for Daybreak Africa Sports. I am Samson O'Malley in Abuja, Nigeria. It's back to you, James, in Washington.
And thank you, Samson. Have a good weekend. That is it for this Friday, June 14th edition of Daybreak Africa. We thank you for spending this week with us. On behalf of the Daybreak Africa team, I'm James Butte in Washington, wishing you in Africa a very good weekend.
Voice of America's news, talk, and music programs are now at the tip of your fingers.
Find everything at www.voaafrica.com. Listen to VOA's program lineup live anytime, day or night. Pick out your favorite shows and listen anytime you want. Download our podcasts. Check VOA Mobile from your cell phone. Subscribe to VOA Newsfeed. VOAnews.com.
On Africa News Tonight, we let the sound tell the story, putting you in the middle of events from Africa's news to world crises. Africa News Tonight comes to you live from the Voice of America on the following shortwave frequencies, 6080 kilohertz and 15580 kilohertz. We are also live on the internet at www.voaafrica.com.